Thank you, Dr. Spears. Good morning, everyone. I'm Doug Needham, and I'm one of the deans here at Redeemer University College. And it's my privilege to welcome you to our keynote addresses this morning. We have two. The first keynote address this morning will be presented by Dr. Harriet Gloss, and I'd like to give you some biographical information on Dr. Gloss. Dr. Gloss holds two chairs at Leiden University in the Netherlands, one in reformational philosophy and one in psychiatry. In addition, he also holds the Dewey Weird Chair in the philosophy department at the Free University in Amsterdam. He is the director of residency training and psychiatrists at Dementia in Zwolle in the Netherlands. And as well, he is the co-founder of the Dutch Foundation of Psychiatry and Religion. Dr. Gloss's research interests include philosophical anthropology, the psychopathology of and religious aspects of anxiety, the significance of Kierkegaardian philosophy for psychology and psychiatry, depression, personality, self, and identity, and the neurobiology of anxiety disorders. Dr. Gloss has traveled a great distance to be with us for this conference. We're very grateful. Please join me in welcoming our first speaker this morning, Dr. Gloss.
Thank you for this kind introduction. Thank you also, Craig, for inviting me to address you on the topic of psychology and philosophy, psychiatry, philosophy, Christian philosophy. I also would like to say that I'm proud of this conference, conference on public theology. I congratulate Greg with the building up this center and having such a high-profile conference at the start of it. And what I will now do and try to do in the remainder of this presentation is to give you first an overview of models of integration. I have four parts. First, an introduction into the subject, then Dewey Weird's worldview approach, and then I will concentrate on possible views on the relationship between religion, spirituality, and mental illness. And then, if time is left, I will go into the subject of what this does mean for the relationship between mental illness and religiosity. I have a rather long presentation, but I decided not to overstretch your attention, so I will keep my time boundaries, and if I don't succeed in reaching the end of my presentation, people who are interested in it can attend the session this afternoon, in which we have a more free exchange of ideas around my presentation, and also perhaps then the final pages, the final slides. So let's start with models of integration. I discuss four approaches, very rough approaches, initial approaches, and then three philosophically inspired attempts. Those of I.M. Barber, Nancy Murphy, and Herman Dewey Weird. And then in the second part, I will say more about Dewey Weird. So the four approaches are professionalism, attitudinalism, as I call it, philosophical criticism, and integration. So, professionalism, with that term I mean the attitude of just doing your job, thinking of your job as something in itself, as something more or less value-free. So for the scientist, this means develop hypotheses and theories, perform experiments, apply methods, and for the professional this means apply the methods you are taught during your professional education in clinical practice. There's a lot to say about this approach. While preparing this talk, I was thinking that most of my work as a philosopher in medicine and as a philosopher in psychiatry consists of trying to make clear that this position doesn't hold, and that my main work as a philosopher in psychiatry is to make clear that this is a very one-sided position. So a lot can be said about it. I will confine my to one remark, that is that reality is not confined to the boundaries of our professions and scientific disciplines. And that in science, of course, there are presuppositions and paradigms that are not at all value-free and that pervade our theoretical thinking and the methods we developed. Of course, there's also a scientific practice in which we exchange ideas, and which of course is also not value-free. And within the professions, the patients we treat don't stop at the boundaries of our thinking. They show all kinds of phenomena that are not limited to that what was taught to us in our professional education. We have to deal with that. We have to deal with patients who are whole persons and are not just carriers of some symptom or dysfunction. So basically, I attack the value-free or value-neutral hypothesis or theory of science and of the professions. Then the attitudinalism. That's the approach which says, well, as a Christian, what you have to do is adopt the right attitude to be a good person, to let's see what it is, what it means to be a Christian in science and to be a Christian as a doctor or as a technician, engineer. So I think a lot can be said in favor of this position. However, it fails because it shows a too limited view on the interconnectedness of science and faith. The notion of an intrinsic connection between the two is given up too soon, I think. Then as a third approach, that was the main approach in which I was educated as a student, that was the approach of philosophical criticism. So what one has to do when one studies a certain theory or professional development is to become aware of the philosophical assumptions behind these theories and behind these professional developments. So the Christian scientist and professional should criticize then the non-Christian background or basic assumptions of scientific models and theories. Again, a lot can be said in favor of this approach. However, it is mainly negative. And also, and that I've come to become aware of only after a while, a decade or so, there is a relative neglect in this approach of the context in which knowledge functions. So basically, this model works with a kind of deductive perspective, that you have philosophy at the top, and then based on that, or at least related to that, scientific theories that derive their assumptions from some philosophical approach, and then these theories are applied in a professional practice or a technical practice, and via these all these steps, these basic assumptions that are basically philosophical pervade or are introduced in a practice, for instance, medical practice. Well, in a certain sense, that is true. However, it is one-sided. In the sense that the knowledge that functions at the level of philosophy in the basic assumptions does function in a different way at the philosophical level compared to the scientific level and to the professional level. So knowledge is not something in itself. Even these basic assumptions behind theories are not something in themselves. They have a meaning that depends on the context in which these assumptions function. So this more or less deductive background idea of the philosophical criticism approach denies a little or ignores a bit too much this contextual aspect of knowledge and of the way basic assumptions function. One example was that as a Christian I was taught already at high school that psychoanalysis was something very non-Christian. And when I entered into medical practice and was a resident in psychiatry, I met, of course, many psychoanalysts. At that time, there were many. And what I noticed that there were enormous differences between all those psychoanalysts. They adopted quite different attitudes toward their patients, which were not at all only inspired by their psychoanalytic background. And the way also they used their psychoanalytic background was also quite different from person to person and depending on the context. Well, then fourth approach, philosophical and theological informed attempts to integration. I want to discuss, as I said, three thinkers, Barber, Murphy, and Doyle. Barber offers a kind of model-like approach to the integration debate. He discerns four models and gives an attempt to synthesis, which is inspired by process philosophy. And Murphy develops a research program for Christian psychologists from a Lakatosian perspective. Lakatos was a Hungarian philosopher of science. I will explain that later. And she lets this research program be determined by Anabaptist theology, which she calls a radical reformation perspective. And then finally, Doyweerd, who offers a worldview-based approach with sharp criticism on scientism and traditional metaphysics and an emphasis on the opening up of creational structures. Well, first, Barber. perhaps some of you know his book, Science and Religion. I use the version of 1997. I can recommend this book. It's very insightful and gives a lot of information. And in some way, it's quite interesting for also for a Doyweerdian thinker to deal with. What Barber does in the first chapters of this book is discern four models of relating science and religion: a conflict model, an independence model, a dialogue model, and a integration model. Example of what does a model mean? A model means that the way scientists and persons with a religion background or religious input into scientific debate is dealt with can be seen from the perspective of one of these four models. And an example of a conflict model was the discussion, well-known discussion, of course, to the Roman Catholic clergy and Galilee. More contemporary conflict is the conflict between biblical literalism and mainstream geology, cosmology, and evolutionary biology. As an example of the independence model, he mentions some forms of Neo-Barthian theology, existentialism, and also the linguistic analysis approach to religion. Basically, what he's aiming here at is some form of fideism. So the thought that the idea that belief, religious belief, is something in itself, that it cannot be refuted by whatever evidence, that it is, it finds its source, so to say, in itself. And excuse from natural theology. So what I noticed in my course, I've given a course on this book, and that many students, secular students, are attracted to this position, because they have the idea that if religion would be true, or if Christian belief would be true, then it would concern such realities that in no way can be addressed or be the object of scientific method. So, in my opinion, it's not only confined to existentialism and neo-Barthian, neo-orthodoxy. I think in a certain sense it's also postmodern thinking tends to this position in general, I think. Then the dialogue model, which has as first focus an analysis of the limit questions, as Barber uses to call them, and the presuppositions of scientific theories, and then compare them to religious models, as he terms them, he mentions them. But in a more deeper exchange of ideas, looking for parallels between what scientists do and what theologians do, for instance. So what he is doing, for instance, is giving a detailed analysis of how the notion of chance is dealt with in theology, and then tries to relate that to some conceptions of God and the way how God reigns reality. And so the chance aspect in physics can be related to a kind of creative reigning in which God gives a lot of freedom to creation to develop and follow its own path. Parallels are there also in the scientist's commitment to truth, kind of ultimate concern, kind of personal touch and personal commitment to the truth, and which can be compared with sort of religious zeal and religious commitment. And then finally, the fourth model, the integration model, in which he discerns three subforms, so to say, natural theology, classical natural theology, trying to find evidence in nature for the existence of God and the way he is. And then what he calls a theology of nature, which is a theology that is informed by scientific findings and that gives a kind of agenda with a political and lifestyle sort of focus. So in this theology of nature, he is aiming at, for instance, environmental ethics as an important focus of such a theology. And such a theology is then informed by knowledge of the natural sciences, but also ideas about human nature and some philosophical ideas. And then finally, as the third subform, is what he calls systematic synthesis. And under this synthesis, he thinks that process philosophy is the best way to provide for this synthesis. So what I think is important to say that it's not at all the case that he tries to find integration in a kind of grand metaphysical solution. So it's not at all the case for Barber that there on first has to have a sound metaphysics, and on the basis of that metaphysics one has to combine and relate and connect and ultimately integrate theological insight and scientific insight and religious experience. No, there's a kind of free exchange between all these domains expressed in this figure, and no deductive or inductive approach. There are just an enormous amount of fields of discussions between all these boxes, so to say, and integration can take place at every stage. So metaphysics is no ultimate basis for integration, no deductive approach. Integration may start at every point in the circle, emphasis on a new theology of nature, and integration remains something model-like, dependent on the context. For instance, in an early context of confrontation between scientists and theologians, it may well be best to restrict oneself to a independence view and just compare views, not go further. While further on in the discussion, one may end with a dialogue approach or with an integration approach. This depends on the context. Of course, he is more inclined to the third and fourth approach, the dialogue and the integration approach, but there's no grand solution for all science-religion debate. No grand integrative synthesis, so to say. Well, I think this is an attractive approach. It's open. However, there are several problems with the process philosophy background of this thinking. I cannot go into that. I mentioned here, I see three problems: the limited notion of evil, Jesus Christ as a theological point, of course, as can only be seen by him as a moral example, and there is little room for what one could call the wickedness of faith. Faith is, in the end, also a kind of deliberate construction, making sense of one's world in the most rational way one can imagine. As an intellectual, you have to make sense of all your convictions. But in a certain, then there's another element in Christian faith which is counterintuitive. That counterintuitive element that cannot be done justice within such an approach, I think. Then Nancy Murphy. Quite different thinker. I discuss here because she recently wrote a book under the title, with some others, Why Psychology Needs Theology. And she comes from California, as was raised as a theologian, later became philosopher, had an interest initially even in psychology, and via work on the of philosophy of religion and then on human nature, she now comes back to the field of psychology. This slide gives the outline, her basic framework of thought. She starts, as I said, with an epistemology which is derived from the work of Imre Lakatos, an epistemologist, who said that in contrary to what Karl Popper thought, that scientists aim at falsification of their theories, theorists aim at consolidation and are aiming at preserving their views. So he coined the term research program, which is now quite familiar and usual to use. A research program has a hard core of basic assumptions, which are not only scientific, but also metaphysical or maybe even religious, basic assumptions and theories which are protected by auxiliary hypotheses and models. And then he says, progress in science is slow and consists of the competition between these research programs. Then the second element in her thought, Nancy Murphy's thought, is what she calls her a radical reformational perspective, or reformation perspective, which is an Anabaptist perspective, in which she places theology at the highest level. There's a kind of hierarchy in which physics and chemistry are at the bottom, and then biology and psychology and social sciences and some other sciences, and then finally theology. And this idea of a hierarchy of sciences is important because, as I see it, she sees integration as a kind of integration between these levels, as a kind of interdisciplinary thinking about how findings at all these levels can be related to one another. So there's no place for metaphysics in this program, and I think her notion of boundary and of boundary questions is not that there is a philosophical question behind or at the boundary, but that the boundary may also be, and is primarily the boundary between one science and another science, not the boundary between science and philosophy, but the boundary between, for instance, biology and psychology, and psychology and social sciences, and so on. And then, and that's the most difficult to swallow part of her thought, she adopts a non-reductive physicalist stance with respect to discussions on human nature. So she is anti-dualist. I cannot explain it here fully, but basically this non-reductive physicalism holds that there is one basic stuff in reality, matter, physical material. So it is a metaphysical monism, materialism, one could say, which is combined with what one could call an epistemological dualism, in the sense that it is allowed to use mental terms, not meaning that they refer to a separate sort of reality, but as a way of speaking about this physical reality with some right in itself to be accounted for in these mental terms. So it's a kind of epistemological dualism combined with metaphysical monism. So this is her research program for Christian psychology. She's quite ambitious in this. And what you see here is are two figures, which the one is derived from, the first one is derived from McIntyre's After Virtue, and it says that basically the task of ethics is to educate people from their untutored nature. They have to be educated to a state in which they may and can fulfill their telos, which is this telos. What is this telos that is functioning as a citizen, as an autark citizen in the polis, in the city-state? This model, based on which is the basis for virtue ethics, she thinks that psychology can be conceived as a science that tries to unravel the processes at a psychological level which are needed to fulfill this idea of human nature fulfilling its telos. So the research program for psychology would then be to first discern what the character is of untutored and ungraced human nature, and then to define what ideal human existence is, and then to discern the means by which the transition from this untutored and ungraced nature to the ideal human existence can be made. Quite ambitious, as I said. So, what is Lakatosian here? It's the hardcore, this which consists of a social ethic of self-renunciation, a kenotic ethic, as she calls it, an ethic also of non-violence, as telos of human life, which is operationalized in theoretical terms. So self-renunciation is operationalized as detachment from material possessions, renunciation of rights to reward, rejection of retaliation, non-violence, and so on. And then what she's going to do, and that's the tricky point, of course, in the whole story, try to find empirical evidence that human nature is best off when it functions according to these theoretical terms. So we see reviews, for instance, literature on altruism and on forgiveness, and on the basis of this the literature on that, which is quite extensive, says concludes that the idea of a egotistic individual, the individual is primarily aiming at its own egotistic needs and not caring for others, that this picture of man is not in accordance with the picture of the scientific theories she has revealed. This is basically her program. So in this respect, she goes much further than Barber. She even criticizes him because he because of his critical realism. I think this ambition is also a hazard